As I mentioned to you guys a little bit earlier this week, I wanted to talk with you tonight about the subject of abortion, which is a very controversial subject at any time, but especially given the fact that we are headed into a presidential election year. It's a topic that's going to be in the news. And while obviously our interest here is not politics, we are certainly interested in the Word of God. And we're interested in what the Word of God has to say on every aspect of life. Jesus, we believe, is king and has all authority on heaven and on earth. So we want to know what his will is in all aspects of life, even those most intimate areas of life. And so that's why I want to talk with you about this issue. The reason I want to talk with you about it this weekend is because we've just marked the anniversary of the Supreme Court decision that struck down abortion laws in the country, the decision known as Roe versus Wade, back in January of 1973. And as Justice Harry Blackmun, who wrote the decision, explained the basis for why the court was going to strike down laws that various states had against abortion, he made this comment: the fact that throughout the major portion of the 19th century, prevailing legal abortion practices were far freer than they are today persuades us that the word person, as used in the 14th Amendment, that's the amendment that says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Well, he says what this tells us is that that word person does not include the unborn. And so what the court basically said is that in the first 3 months of pregnancy, no state can restrict abortion at all. In the next 3 months, if the states want to, they can restrict abortion. And then after the first two trimesters, then abortion can be restricted throughout the United States. So what I want to talk with you about tonight is this basis of belief in abortion rights, but also what I believe are the wrongs that are done by abortion. When you're in speech class, you're taught that your biggest point, the one that's going to take the most time, should come last. But actually, because this first point is so pivotal and foundational to everything else we're going to talk about tonight, it's going to come first. I hesitate to tell you that because I know some of you are going to start timing, and then depending on how long it takes me to get through the first point, you're going to start doing algebra for what's coming next. But it is an important point that I want us to establish here at the outset as the first wrong of abortion, the one that's most fundamental. And the first wrong of abortion is that abortion violates the right to life that every human being has from God. And I'd just like for you to open to the first page of the text of your Bible, to Genesis chapter 1, to emphasize why we as Christians believe that human beings have the right to life. In Genesis chapter 1, on the sixth day, it says in verse 26, "Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness." Verse 27 says, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." You've heard me discuss this concept before in other lessons. In the ancient world, kings would set up statues to be likenesses to represent their authority over their empire, over their realm. Genesis 1 borrows that concept, but says that what God is basically giving to the world as a symbol of his authority isn't a statue. The likeness or the image is humanity itself. Humanity is given by God this unique status of representing God's dominion. And so that's why it says up in verse 26, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, birds of the heavens, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." In other words, human beings have a unique status compared to any other living thing on the planet, simply because we're human beings and we are made in the image of God. It's not because of what color we are. It's not because of what social class we come from. It's not on the basis of how intelligent we are. It's not on the basis of any external thing like that. It is simply on the basis of the fact that we are human beings, that we have this status in the sight of God. And that's why, as the Bible then talks about the value and sanctity of human life, It says things like what you find over in Genesis chapter 9, in the aftermath of the story of Noah, where the Lord says this, in verse 5, "For your lifeblood I will require a reckoning, from every beast I will require it, from every man, from his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man." Verse 6, "For whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image." God here even invokes the most severe penalty if somebody commits murder. And the reason is because, while he says earlier in this chapter, it is okay for you to kill and to eat animals, because human beings have a status as the image of God, you're not to kill one another. You're not to murder one another. It is for this reason, then, that you have a statement like this in the writings of the first century Jewish author Josephus, who, by the way, is writing in a day and time in which abortion was practiced. Abortion is certainly nothing new. It was practiced in the ancient world. And he says this about the Jewish law. "The law, moreover, enjoins us to bring up all our offspring and forbids women to cause abortion of what is begotten or to destroy it afterward. And if any woman appears to have done so, she will be a murderer of her child by destroying a living creature and diminishing humankind." But you know, quite frankly, even if you didn't believe in God, even if you were an atheist, unless you're one of that small minority of people like the gentleman we've talked about recently in Bible class who denies there's any right and wrong whatsoever, just about everybody believes that human beings have rights as human beings. I happen to think we as Christians have a foundation to explain why that is the case that other people do not. But even if you were to go, for example, and read the United Nations Charter for Human Rights, it's going to say the very same thing, just not with the foundation of belief in God. So the question before us then amounts to this. Is an unborn child in the womb a human being? And while it is very common to hear people say, well, this is a very technical and difficult question, the reality is it's not a difficult question, not from a purely biological point of view. So somebody had posted on the internet in an article on abortion a link to this YouTube video, which if you want to search for it, it's from the Nucleus Medical Media Company. And it's like one of those, when I was a kid, it was film strips. So I don't think you guys even know what a film strip is. You don't know what the smell of the burning bulb is like in your classroom. Anyhow, but of course now I have YouTube videos. Well, this is like one of those, except it is about the process of fertilization. I would just simply say to you, point people to this video to show them biologically what science understands about life beginning at conception. The very first sentence, "Fertilization is the epic story of a single sperm facing incredible odds to unite with an egg and form a new human life. It is the story of us all." And then after you watch the video, the conclusion of it says this, "This new single cell, the zygote, is the beginning of a new human being. I froze the frame right when the male and genetic female material are about to come together and form the actual DNA that will determine your hair color and eye color and everything else." My point is that simply from a biological point of view, there is no question whatsoever that at conception, what you have is a human life. It's life. What other life is it? So the real issue then is, well, is that human life a person? That is, a person who should be protected by the law. Remember that quote from Blackman I gave you at the start of the lesson tonight. What he's denying is that an unborn child is a person. You can't really deny that this is a human being, but what they're denying is that this is a person. It's getting increasingly difficult to do this, though, because of technology. Some of you have posted some of your sonograms on Facebook. And now because of 3D and 4D technology, those sonograms are increasingly precise. So here is one that shows a child at 12 weeks. By the way, still within the first trimester, right at the edge of it, in which the court says there can be no restrictions against abortion. The lead in my quartet lunch break posted this sonogram picture. He had twins, Owen and Libby. And I don't know if you can make out what's going on here, but Owen is kicking his sister in the eyeball right here. If you can make that out, he's sticking his toe right in her eye. Well, when you look at pictures like this, it's very difficult to deny what is obvious from science, which is that what we have here is a human being. But what some people would say is, well, this living organism can't exercise the rights of a person. So, for example, Chris Matthews, a commentator on a news channel, says, the pro-life platform, which would give 14th Amendment rights, whatever that means, life, liberty, and then when he said it like this, property rights. How ridiculous. To a fetus that's just been, or rather an egg that's just been fertilized, right after sex, if you will, to have a notion that this would be a person. So you see what he's saying is, well, this might be a living organism and maybe a human being by technical biological standards, but, you know, a fertilized egg can't go out and exercise its rights to life, liberty, and property. Now, many people have pointed out the serious fallacies of this line of reasoning, which is if you can't exercise the rights of a person, therefore you don't have legal status as a person. This will sound ridiculous, but it's a simple illustration. Let's say that you go to have surgery, and our good friend over here, Dr. Gill, who has the same occupation I do, namely puts people to sleep, he puts you under. At that moment, when you're under anesthesia, can you exercise the rights of a person? No, you cannot. Now somebody says, well, but you see, you've got the capability, you've got the potential to. Once you wake up, you'll be able to. Exactly right. I told you all the other night in Bible class, we've been using these terms, potentiality and actuality, and I told you this is a rich concept once you get the hang of it. Obviously, a newly conceived human being isn't at that moment exercising the rights to property and so forth, but they undoubtedly have the potential to, just as surely as someone who has been put under has the potential to. Well, then here's the problem. Since that line of reasoning is obviously a dead end, and it's hard to deny the fact that a baby in the womb is a human being and certainly has the potential to eventually display all of the rights and prerogatives that we do as those who were born, the next step is to say, well, you know, wait a minute. A baby who is 3 months or 4 months before being born can't really exercise the rights to property. How many rights, like property rights, can a baby who's just been born exercise? And the answer is, not any more than a baby who hasn't been born yet. So you would think, well, the obvious point of consistency would say, well, of course, no one would ever think that it is okay to put to death a newborn baby and say, well, even though that's a human being, that's not a person who should receive the dignity and protection of the law, because at this moment, as a two-day-old or just a few days old, like the child we had announced tonight, who's about to have surgery, somebody's going to say, oh, that's not a person, right? Of course, that would be foolish. Who would ever say anything like that? This guy would, Peter Singer, an Australian ethicist, who makes the point the location of a baby inside or outside of the womb cannot make such a moral difference. We cannot coherently hold that it is all right to kill a fetus before birth, but as soon as the baby is born, everything must be done to keep it alive. Fantastic, that's great. You see the point. Oh, except there's more. The solution, however, is not to accept the pro-life view that the fetus is a human being. The solution is the very opposite, to abandon the idea that all human life is of equal worth. Well, in a grisly way, at least he's consistent. So my point to you, first of all, tonight is simply this. Abortion denies an unborn child the fundamental right to life that every human being has. Of course, that child is not displaying its full capacities as a person yet, but surely will unless violently interfered with. That's the first wrong I wanted to present to you tonight. Here is the second wrong that I would like to get before us tonight with regard to abortion. Abortion violently disrupts God's intended purpose for sexual intimacy. Now, if you still have your Bible open to those opening chapters of Genesis, you may go back to chapter 1, where the Bible continues in verse 28. We left off at the end of verse 27, I think, where it says, male and female, he created them. Verse 28 says, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful, and multiply, and fill the earth. So God made humanity in his image, men and women equally dignified in the mind of God, but he also made them distinctively, male and female, with distinctive physiology. And the obvious purpose of that distinctive physiology is to be able to have children. We even call those differences reproductive organs for that very reason. And what the text is telling us here in Genesis chapter 1 is that God did this with the intention that men and women would unite together, and united together would have children. The Bible also teaches that this physical intimacy has another important purpose. It's a purpose that we all understand, and that is to unite the man and woman together in an incredible relationship that is so close that it is described as a one-flesh relationship. You can see this at the end of Genesis 2, where it says in verse 24, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So these twin purposes of the reason that there are the physiological differences between men and women, they are in order to have children and in order to bind the husband and wife together in this permanent, mutual, and exclusive relationship. And what this means is that what God has all along intended in designing us with this capability is that it is something that is supposed to be limited to a relationship called marriage. A relationship which would be the suitable context in which children could be born. It doesn't mean, of course, that every time a man and a woman who are married have sex, that the ultimate goal that they have must be to have children. But it does mean that that is an intended goal that God has in the very act. And sometimes it does happen even when you don't expect it. I thought about doing a survey tonight, but I'm not going to. But I would imagine if I asked the question, how many of you in this room tonight were lovely surprises to your mother and father, that there would be a few hands that would go up? You were not anticipated, but you were the natural outcome of one of the intended purposes that God has for physical intimacy. So what I want you to understand is this. There is a clear link in Scripture between us being made as male and female, the purpose of marriage, and sexual intimacy and children. Those things all go together. And it is no surprise then that in our culture, as we have systematically undermined each of those beliefs, we have seen the rise of, first of all, the sexual revolution, which redefined what sex was for, which was not to bring a man and woman together in marriage to unite them and to possibly create children to be raised in the context of a marriage. Sex was redefined as something you simply do just for your own personal satisfaction. Then marriage was defined to be something that you do as long as you want to stay in the relationship, but then if you want to get out, that's okay. It was inevitable then that something like abortion would become widespread. The vast majority of abortions are performed for those who are not married. And it links into the entire redefinition of what it is to be human, what it is to be male and female, what the purpose of marriage is, what the purpose of sex is. The latest thing with same-sex marriage is just one more chapter in this long series of redefinitions. A few weeks ago, I was watching television. I think I was watching a ball game. And the ball game ended, and a movie started up on the same channel. I don't remember what the movie was. It was one of those horrible hookup movies. It was all about a bunch of guys who were buddies and the women they were trying to hook up with. All I remember is, as the movie started, Chris Rock was narrating it. And as the movie starts, he says, you know, it used to be, well, he talks about how, you know, men have always pursued women and women have always sought security, that kind of thing, played for a humorous effect. But at one point, I almost fell out of it. I wish I could have recorded it to show this clip. He said, it used to be here in our country that we understood that the only expression of sexual intimacy was supposed to be in marriage. But now that's all changed. And then the movie was kind of off and running. I just thought how interesting that even although, again, it was played for humorous purposes, he acknowledges that at the start of the movie. Well, what I'm saying to you then is this. When people do not respect what God has intended for sexual intimacy, and the results in the way that God has naturally built it into who we are as male and female, the result of that is a child that has not been brought into the context that God all along designed for this relationship to be, then abortion becomes the way to deal with the consequence of actions which took place because people were ignoring the will of God. I feel strongly that in our culture especially, we have an enormous double standard. First of all, it is the woman who, because of nature, the way God has designed us, goes to get the abortion. My own personal experience, though, of young Christian women who have had abortions has been that they were actually manipulated and pressured and exploited by the men who did not want to bear their part of the burden of responsibility for what they have done. And it is unfair that because of our society, women are far more stigmatized in this regard. If a man is sexually immoral, then he is considered to be sowing his wild oats. He's considered just to be a player. But if a woman is immoral, then she is, in our society, even to this day, as feminized as we have become, she is still always held in a much lower standard of respect than the man. And that's one of the reasons why so many women in this situation then feel a certain amount of pressure. So I want to make it abundantly clear tonight that the lion's share of the responsibility, as I see it, for the kind of immorality I'm talking about, must lie at the feet of the men who are using women in the way that the Bible sometimes even speaks about, like in the story of Amnon and Tamar. That doesn't mean that there is not immorality on all points, but you understand what I'm saying. When talking about this issue, we need to be absolutely clear and forthright that the responsibility in this regard does not fall 100% with the women who are involved. The point I want you to see is this, that abortion violently disrupts what God has intended as a purpose for sexual intimacy. And here's the third thing that I want you to see tonight that is wrong with abortion. And that is it does display a certain cruelty, a certain hardness of heart. Would you look with me over at the end of Romans chapter 1, one of the saddest passages in the Bible, because it shows what happens when a culture leaves its knowledge of God. It actually is the very sort of thing we even see in our own culture. It starts out in Romans chapter 1 and verse 24 with sexual immorality. And then that broadens to same-sex immorality, verses 26 and 27. And then in verse 28, Paul says, God gives people over to a depraved mind who leave him, and recounts a wide variety of what you might call social sins, man's inhumanity against man. In the very last part of this list, in verse 31, it says in the English Standard Version, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. That word heartless. The New American Standard says unloving. The old King James Version said, without natural affection. If you look up what this word means in Greek, that actually is a pretty good translation. It refers to someone who's lacking in good feelings for others and jeopardizes the relationships that society is built on, like political or familial relationships. Now, why do I bring this up? Because if I were to ask right now in this room, and I actually am going to ask for you to respond, if you are a parent and you're in this room, would you give your life for your child? Would you raise your hand, please? Very good. Now, that is the natural, normal response of any parent, that you would give your life for your child. In fact, we would consider it extremely abnormal and evil behavior for a parent to willingly sacrifice the life of their child for their benefit. We understand that a parent just is inherently filled with such love for their child, they would give their life for the benefit of their child. But in abortion, what is taking place is the exact opposite of that. In abortion, a life is being taken for the benefit of the parent. Not just the woman who is involved. As I said, in many instances, and certainly all of the ones I know of personally, it has actually been the callousness of the man that has been far more difficult to even comprehend as he has manipulated the woman in question. The reality is this. I realize there can be very difficult, extreme circumstances. And if you were on social media all over the weekend, because it was the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, you probably saw videos exploiting some of these. I just want to show you, though, if you go to the National Institute of Health website, you can find a study published in 2013 that talks about the reasons that women have abortions. And here's what the study found. The predominant themes identified as reasons for seeking abortion included financial reasons, timing, partner-related reasons, and the need to focus on other children. Because in some instances, there were multiple factors. That's why these numbers don't add up to 100. They go up beyond that. But what you can see here is that the reasons that are being given in these surveys by those who are having the abortions are, I can't afford the child right now. The timing is not good to have a child right now. There's problems between me and the partner right now, or I've already got enough children as it is and I can't focus on any more. That's the reality behind the staggering numbers for abortion in our culture. Far more representative and typical of the kind of story that really is at the heart of abortion are these situations in which basically what it boils down to is, it is a huge inconvenience to me to have this child. It's a huge inconvenience to the father of the child. And so let's abort the child rather than embrace that inconvenience. I know sometimes we like to stereotype who it is that has abortions. You know, it's those who are poor, minorities, etc. It isn't just them. Although 85% of abortions are performed for those who are not married, there are some abortions performed even for well-to-do married women. Like, for example, the head of Planned Parenthood, who in an interview with Katie Couric talked about her abortion. Listen to what she says. It was a decision my husband and I made. It was a personal decision. We have three children that we adore, that the center of my life, and we decided that that was as big as our family needed to be. It wasn't anything more dramatic than that. I got to say, if I'm child number three in her family, I'm a little bit nervous when I read that, you know. What if she decided that one child before? I don't know how a person can say that. Not when you've seen so many of your friends brokenhearted because they've lost children. I don't see how a person can say that without a certain ironness to the heart. Every parent has an inherent desire to give their life for their child, not the other way around, not to give the life of the child for them. Every woman especially has been given by God the blessing of the womb, designed by God to protect the child at its most vulnerable moments of development. The heartlessness that destroys that child in that circumstance, in the very womb that is supposed to be the refuge in which the child is nourished to full-born life, is hard to understand. Here's another point, though, to consider. The financial hardship and difficulty of a child doesn't end at birth, does it? I mean, I'm not a parent, but as I look around the room, parents, does it get more expensive after they're born? It does, right? So think about this. If your worldview says that a fetus is not a person, and if simple logic says, well, there's really not much difference between a newborn baby and a fetus in terms of personhood, exercising rights, question. What if it happens that after the child is born, but before it reaches whatever you think the level of personhood is, you decide, you know, after all, this is turning out to be really expensive and inconvenient. What would logic say then? I'll tell you what these people say. A couple of ethicists who've written a paper that they call After Birth Abortion say this. We claim that killing a newborn could be ethically permissible in all the circumstances where abortion would. Such circumstances include cases where the newborn has the potential to have an acceptable life, but the well-being of the family is at risk. Do you get what they're saying? The child is born, and the family at that point decides, this is going to be tough on us. What they're saying is this: we propose to call this practice after birth abortion rather than infanticide, to emphasize the moral status of the individual killed is comparable with that of a fetus, on which abortions in the traditional sense are performed rather than that of a child. So if we just call this living thing that's killed, and by the way, you notice they have to acknowledge an individual's being killed, an individual what? Well, it's an individual human, but if we'll just simply deny that this is really a person, then, hey, since it's okay to abort a fetus if it inconveniences the family, why not kill the little baby? And when news of this paper got out, they said, oh, we didn't really mean, we only meant for philosophers and ethicists to read this. Well, I can understand why you didn't want a lot of common sense average people to read this. People aren't so filled with immoral philosophy, but they understand that it is wrong to kill a little baby. Christy and I recently watched this series on Amazon called The Man in the High Castle. Some of you may have read the book, some of you may have seen this. It's one of those alternate history programs. And in this case, the alternate history is the Nazis and the Japanese won the Second World War. So the Eastern United States has become the Greater Reich. The West Coast has become part of the Empire of Japan. There's sort of a no man's land in between. And there's a scene early on in this series that just staggered both of us, where one of the heroes in the story is driving, and he gets a flat in the Nazi territory, and a policeman pulls up. And you think, uh-oh, he's going to get in trouble. The policeman is as helpful as could be, offers him a sandwich and everything else. And all of a sudden, this ash starts falling from the sky. And he says, what is this? Is it snowing? It's not cold enough to be snow. He goes, oh, no, that's the ash from the hospital. Every Tuesday, they incinerate the crippled and infirm. When I read these people who are denying that human beings are persons because they can't exercise all of their potentials, it's like I'm living in an alternate world in which values that are far different than what common sense would tell us is the case. You all know my story. A little over 48 years ago, an unwed mother in central Kentucky who was paid no attention and told she was on her own by the father of the child, chose to give birth anyway and to raise the child. Did it make life tough on her as she worked a full-time job and then a part-time job and then lived at home most of her life? Dealt with a lot of shame because it was back in the days when it wasn't so accepted. And the double standard was even more vicious. Did it inconvenience her? You better believe it. About a year later, another unwed mother decided to go to a home for unwed mothers in Kansas City, Missouri. And she realized she couldn't take care of her little baby girl, so she decided to give birth and give her up for adoption. And Bob and Jackie Bennett picked that little girl up. And I'm really grateful for that one. So I don't speak to you tonight with a lack of mercy and compassion for those who are caught in difficult situations. But I just say to you that we must understand what is at stake here is what it is to be a human being. And that the wrongs of abortion are incredibly profound. There are other evils in our culture. There are other things that are wrong. There are other ways to dehumanize people. I understand that. But this is just so basic. It's why it is important for us to be able to give voice for those who right now have no voice. Now, as I said to you, we are entering into a campaign season. But my focus for tonight is not on political activism. Our theme this year is doing the will of God from the heart. The most important thing that we as Christians can do is to share the gospel of Jesus Christ from the heart. Despite all the ad campaigns and all the propaganda, there are women who make this decision and whose hearts are broken because of it. They, of all people, need to hear about Jesus and about his love and his compassion and his forgiveness, to know that his grace is always extended to them. And that even as society may shun them and stigmatize them and exploit them, that he will never do that. We have to be the people who, when the forces of the world that have turned away from God wreak havoc and destruction, can come along in its wake and with the grace and power of God try to help repair those whose lives have been broken by godlessness. So I encourage you to have a soft and tender heart, and to tell people the story of Jesus, to urge people to be in obedience to Jesus Christ, to live lives that acknowledge and honor human life, lives that acknowledge and honor the sanctity of marriage, lives that acknowledge and honor what love is truly all about. Love does not seek its own, right? Jesus is the ultimate example of that. I can't imagine a story that is any more diametrically opposed to abortion in the story of the cross, a story of self-sacrifice to give to everyone. And tonight, that's our invitation. If you need to respond, we ask you to come. Always standing.